Welcome back. I am Ari Melber in for Melissa Harris-Perry. 781 days. That's how long American hikers Shane Bauer and Josh Fatale were in jail in Iran on espionage charges. Shane spent 4 months in solitary confinement, an experience so defining that when he did make it out and back home 7 months later, he began investigating how we use that same punishment here in the U.S. He found many people who think we over-incarcerate and over-punish. And in a new report from Mother Jones Magazine, he describes how many are rethinking our criminal justice policies, including some Republicans. Now, to understand this reevaluation, I think you have to look at how we got here. Today's broken, overcrowded, and unjust prison system can really be traced to this moment, June 17th, 1971.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Even then, though, few understood just how much offense the government was about to play. Republicans led the way, and many Democratic politicians followed suit. That included Speaker Tip O'Neill, who reacted to the overdose death of Boston Celtics star draft pick Len Bias with a big anti-drug campaign. Democrats wanted to look tough on drugs that campaign year. And that campaign, which started with an emphasis on enforcing the law, became an arms race for who could pass new laws. By 1986, that led Congress to pass the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which authorized very long jail terms for nonviolent drug use with mandatory minimums. It passed the Senate by a vote of 97-2, with 46 Democrats on board. And that policy, forcing judges to put users in jail, often regardless of their individual situation or any mitigating circumstances, well, that drove today's prison realities. A prison population of more than 2.4 million people. That is more prisoners per capita than any other country ever. It's a number that has quadrupled since 1980 alone, and those numbers have gotten so bad, we are actually now living through a pretty remarkable backlash to the backlash. The over-incarceration crowd is retreating. Years of civil rights organizing, including the argument that these policies are unconstructive and racially unjust, coupled with expensive prisons and tight budgets, are driving what I think is a revolution, and it has two parts. One, a rejection of the 1980s era politics of crime and fear and over-incarceration and the stigmatization and criminalization of even minor drug offenses like marijuana use. And then number two, a serious embrace, and this is important, of alternatives to prison, treatment, education, specialized courts, and really grappling with recidivism, something we should all care about. That is why President Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder embraced sentencing reform, like executive action, to reduce mandatory minimums, and a new system to consider commuting the sentences of people who are still serving time under the old crack cocaine disparity. And it's why some Republicans, to their credit, are changing gears. Look, this is a good example. Here's what Newt Gingrich said to the New York Times in 1992. We have to build enough prisons so there are enough beds that every violent criminal in America is locked up, and they will serve real time, and they will serve their full sentence, and they do not get out on good behavior. Shane Bauer flagged that in his Mother Jones article, but in 2011, here's what Gingrich said. There's an urgent need to address the astronomical growth in the prison population with its huge costs and its loss of human potential. We can no longer afford business as usual with prisons. It's not just former politicians either. The 2012 GOP platform, written by RNC members, uses what I think is a structuralist critique of prisons, that it's not only bad people who become criminals, but bad laws that categorize people as criminals. Look at the platform's prison reform section. It says, quote, "The resources of the federal government's law enforcement and judicial systems have been strained by unfortunate expansions, the overcriminalization of behavior, and the overfederalization of offenses." New bills from Republican senators Mike Lee and Rand Paul, both with Democratic co-sponsors, propose drastic reductions in mandatory minimums. Now, how are those bills doing? Well, you may not have heard about this, but the Senate Judiciary Committee just passed the Lee-Durbin Smarter Sentencing Bill by an overwhelming 13-5 vote. And unlike most bills in D.C., it's ready for a full vote on the Senate floor. Reforming the criminal justice system is never politically easy. We have a failed war on drugs in this country. It was started by both parties, and there are signs it may be ended by both parties. Our panel today reflects some of the revolution on this issue. Judge Tim Lewis, who was appointed by President George H.W. Bush to the prestigious Third Circuit Court of Appeals. He's received many awards, including recognition in the Best Lawyers for America list for regulatory law and the Minority Bar Committee Award for the Pennsylvania Bar. Again with us, Advancement Project co-director Judith Brown Dianis, Judge Billy Murphy, who served as a circuit court judge in the city of Baltimore as a criminal defense attorney. He's been named one of the top 100 trial lawyers in the U.S., as well as Reason Magazine's Peter Suderman. And on remote, Shane Bauer, the investigative journalist behind that Mother Jones piece, joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to you all, Shane. Let me start with you. Your previous piece has looked at solitary confinement in America. Now this piece, you're looking at the Republicans changing their position. Why?
Well, I think it's interesting that right now, you know, after three decades of kind of a massive rise in our prison population, that we're seeing a shift. In 2009, our prison population start falling, and you know, a lot of this is actually coming from conservative policies. Texas's prison population has fallen 20% since 2007. You're seeing, you know, people like Newt Gingrich, Rand Paul call for a repeal of mandatory minimums, and you know, they're kind of shifting a lot of conservative states right now. There's a group called Right on Crime that's really kind of leading the way in this.
Yeah, and you mentioned Rand Paul. He spoke about Judge Lewis, who's here at the table. Let's take a listen to that and get your response.
Federal Judge Timothy Lewis recalls a case where he had to send a 19-year-old to prison for conspiracy. What was the conspiracy? The young man was in a car where drugs were found. I don't know about you, and this is Judge Lewis, but I'm pretty sure one of us might have been in a car in our youth at one point in time where there might have been drugs in the car.
Judge Lewis, your take there?
You know, when Senator Paul made those remarks, I got a call from a colleague of mine at my law firm who said, I never thought the day would come when Rand Paul would be quoting Tim Lewis. But I think that for those of us who care deeply about this issue and have been writing and working and fighting for reform, we don't care where the support comes from. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to people like Weldon Angelos, who's serving 55 years in federal prison for selling marijuana on three occasions, a total amount of $350 worth of marijuana, because he had a firearm, allegedly, on his person at the time. Weldon Angelos doesn't care that it comes from Senator Paul, Senator Durbin, Tim Lewis, or anyone else. But this is a welcome convergence, I think, of ideologies at a time when greater bipartisanship is truly needed. I think that Senator Paul and many on the conservative side of the aisle have recognized that it is very difficult to make the argument that one is for less government and less government spending and not be in favor of prison reform and other means of reducing what has become a significant problem.
Mm-hmm. Peter?
I think that the interesting thing about this issue is that no matter how you look at it, when you look at the facts, regardless of your ideology, regardless of your desired outcome, the conclusion is pretty clear. We are spending too much money and locking up too many people. The federal prison system is right now operating at 136% of capacity. It's on track to 155%. I mean, that's just not sustainable. The Rand Paul, Mike Lee proposals are supposed to save about $2.5 billion and reduce prison bed usage by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, perhaps over the next couple of years. I mean, this is the sort of thing that needs to be done, and regardless of where you come from, this is the sort of thing that you can see the case for.
Yeah, and Shane, bringing you back in here, I mean, Peter's speaking from the vantage point of writing for a libertarian magazine. They have been consistent on this for some time. It is really the politicians who have finally found the conservative arguments here, right?
Right, yeah, and I think, you know, there's, if you look at the polls in Texas, for example, Republicans in Texas, in a recent poll, were 80% in favor of drug treatment over incarceration for drug offenders. You know, and then you have a situation like in California where you have a Democratic governor that is resisting reforms. You know, and last summer, Jerry Brown vetoed a bill that would have reduced sentences for low-level drug crimes, and you actually had conservatives. This group Right on Crime that was lobbying for that bill in California.
And I should mention, Shane, to your point, not just cost, but Judith, also to the issues of the impact on communities of color. Rand Paul quoted Michelle Alexander to talk about this as Jim Crow.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Yeah. The collateral consequences for communities of color, I mean, it's devastated our communities from not only the fact that people are being taken out of our communities, but on top of that, at the end of the day, they lose their voting rights, they have a hard time finding employment on the other side, and so we have all of these other impacts that disproportionately impact people of color and communities of color.
I'm glad you mentioned voting rights, because the Obama administration actually has a new proposal on that we are going to get to. I also want to thank Shane Bauer for your reporting and for joining us from Colorado. And still to come, Orange is the New Black author, the real-life Piper Kerman. But first, the impact of Attorney General Eric Holder. That's next.
And through the Department's Civil Rights Division and other components, we will continue to work with allies like the Department of Education and others throughout the federal government and beyond to confront the school-to-prison pipeline and those zero-tolerance school discipline policies that really do not promote public safety and that transform too many educational institutions from doorways of opportunity into gateways to the criminal justice system.
That was Attorney General Eric Holder challenging how so many young people enter the prison pipeline. He was addressing the American Bar Association from August. He also outlined the Justice Department's plan to reduce mandatory minimum sentencing, which we mentioned, for nonviolent drug crimes. Before he became the first black attorney general in U.S. history, Holder saw how mandatory sentences worked firsthand when he was a D.C. trial judge. Last year, in fact, he told the Daily Beast, quote, "I saw an ocean of young men come before me who should have been the future of my city, destined to serve long jail terms and then spend their lives dealing with all the negative consequences of being an ex-offender." As Holder approaches these changes to federal mandatory minimums, he does so while making this moral and civil rights claim. We go back to our esteemed panel here for this special discussion. Judge, talk to us about that, both how children end up getting treated immediately as potential criminals rather than some other approach, and what it does when they come back out of prison.
Over-incarceration, as Michelle Alexander has pointed out, is the single worst problem black people have to rebuild families, to educate children, to make sure that everyone is as productive as a human being is capable of being in a society of otherwise great opportunity. And so we've got to stop this over-incarceration as quickly as possible if we're going to put black people back on the road to productivity. But I'm skeptical about these reforms, not because I'm not enthusiastic. I'm very enthusiastic about what I hear and what I see. But the resistance on the ground is going to be overwhelming. Prosecutors are already up in arms about it. They're emotionally invested in the old way of doing business. They're used to sending people to jail for long periods of time and not giving a damn. Judges are in the same position. They're used to the system. There have only been a minority of judges who protested against the existing regime. And so I don't anticipate there's going to be quick change. That's why Obama's appointment of judges is a very critical step in bringing all of this to being. And Republicans are now trying to sabotage his efforts to fill all of the vacancies in the federal system.
Let me go to your point to Judge Lewis, and I should mention many of the prosecutors' associations have said they don't want the mandatory minimums taken away. And interestingly, they haven't said mandatory minimums are always good. What they've said is it helps us threaten and bully people into a plea bargain.
Yeah, it's an absurd argument. It's an unfortunate position, and prosecutors have not sat there and had to sentence a young 19-year-old to 10 years in prison for a first offense, never been in trouble before in his life, had an opportunity to go to college. What is the gain in that? There is no gain in that to society or to anyone else. Prosecutors don't have to sentence somebody, as I mentioned, Weldon Angelos, to 55 years in prison for selling $350 worth of marijuana. It's absolutely absurd, and it is outrageous. These are medieval sentences. They do nothing to benefit society. They do everything to hinder our economic development, societal development, and obviously family. Families are directly impacted.
But Tim, I disagree with you fundamentally on the point about prosecutorial power. it is prosecutorial power that is driving this system.
Well, I didn't address power. I addressed
let me make my point.
Of course, that's the problem. It's the power. They have too much power.
They don't want to give it up.
Yes.
They now set the sentences. They have the charging power. These mandatory minimums and the sentencing guidelines give them this enormous power to coerce people to plead guilty. And by the time they pled guilty, the judge's hands are tied. And so Tim Lewis's of the world don't have a choice. They have to impose the sentences that in effect had been imposed by prosecutorial power. Hmm. And the system was designed to give prosecutors this coercive power.
Yes, but the question had to do with, and you and I do agree, but the question had to do with prosecutors' positions on mandatory minimum sentences.
And they want to hold on to the power. Yeah.
And what I said and what I believe is that that's just an absurd argument. They have not been in the position where they've actually had to impose a sentence nor live with the ramifications.
But that's where I disagree with you, because they have already imposed the sentence that you have to rubber stamp as a federal judge. They're doing it.
That is true. That is true.
And we need sweeping changes with regard to prosecutors, who's appointed as prosecutors, who's in the pipeline, how they, you know, in some places where they get elected, who is being elected to those seats. Clearly we saw in recent trials, like the Dunn trial, that prosecutors mm-hmm. make all the difference, and people need to wake up and understand the power that they have.
I think you put it well in the Dunn trial, as well as the prosecution of George Zimmerman, something we're touching on later in the hour, raised these issues. We are going to move from some of the bad news to back to the good news, particularly what's working up next, the surprising place where reform is working. Stay with us. It's no surprise that Texas has aimed to be tough on crime for many years, but recently Texas has found that relying on prison for so many different infractions, from adults using nonviolent drug offenses to children's mistakes at school, well, it turned out to be pretty tough on Texas and its budget. In 2012, only the federal system's population of prison was larger than Texas's prison population. Back in 2006, Texas was facing a prison system that would cost more than $2 billion. That kind of cost didn't just move Texas voters, it moved one of the most recognizable conservatives in the state, Rick Perry. So in 2007, faced with another prison reform bill, Perry sat down with reformers to make changes. And now this is Texas, where it can feel like the Democrats are on the right and Republicans are off the grid. But here in Texas, Perry hashed out a bipartisan package. It created a new criminal justice legislative oversight committee to evaluate reforms and successes. It expanded drug courts, which are key to push treatment over prison, $241 million to create parole and probation treatment programs, shorten probation terms, and a medical parole program. And it's been long enough that the results are coming in. The state's prison population has stabilized. Texas closed a state prison for the first time in 2011. And by locking up fewer people, the reform saved, projected more than $2 billion for Texas by 2012. And according to a new report by the Vera Institute of Justice, Texas isn't the only state working on this. Since 2000, 29 states have actually enacted laws to increase some kind of judicial discretion for sentencing. And according to one report, the three-year recidivism rate for inmates released in 2007 improved to 24.3% over the old rate of 31%. That's a 22% decline. That's where I bring back in the panel and talk about the fact that recidivism is something that everyone cares about, because you don't want to send people off to jail and send them on a cycle of repeat offenses. And what we're finding is, and I'll start with the judges, what we're finding is when you actually take people and you not only deal with whether or not they should have a long, endless term, but whether they should have programs, drug courts, treatment, education in prison, the recidivism rate, which is something everyone opposes, the recidivism rate drops.
You know, Ari, it's as I said before, this is a very welcome ideological convergence. We have different conservatives' approach and the more progressive approach that the Democrats seem to pursue, meeting here and recognizing that alternatives do work and are important, that thought-out programs that are designed to affect the status of inmates and obviously affect their status after they leave prison can work, as opposed to the traditional just send them in and let them and sit there for many, many years and so forth. So this is a good thing. Texas's program has been very successful for the reasons that you've just pointed out. It is being copied elsewhere around the country. There are more. We see more alternative sentencing courts and sentencing approaches developing in states throughout the country. And they have had an impact on recidivism, and that obviously is very important to all of us. So yeah, it's a good development.
Let me play some sound from Attorney General Eric Holder praising the states. Take a listen.
Alongside other important reforms, in Texas, investments in drug treatment for nonviolent offenders and changes to parole policies brought about a reduction in the prison population of more than 5,000 inmates last year alone. The same year, similar efforts helped Arkansas reduce its prison population by more than 1,400. From Georgia, North Carolina, and Ohio to Pennsylvania, Hawaii, and far beyond, reinvestment and serious reforms are improving public safety and saving precious resources.
These reforms, as they're called, are not really reforms at all. They're like a person who's overeaten, and the doctor tells him that unless he cuts back on his food intake, he's gonna get sick. It isn't a change in the diet, and that's what we really need. So instead of the bad food of the war on drugs, we need to eliminate the war on drugs. I'm a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and I identify more with the libertarians on this issue than with the Democrats, and that is that as long as we have drug prohibition, we're gonna have a steady diet of bad food, over-incarceration. Mm-hmm. And these so-called reforms are like putting Band-Aids on the cancer that is the war on drugs.
Judge, let me go to you on the nutrition.
Well, you know, a song is coming on here. Money, 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 money.
That's right.
I mean, this is where you find your partners because the Republicans are saying too much money. But at the end of the day, we have to have a change in thinking so that we're thinking about rehabilitation
Correct.
Instead of
Correct.
Punishment. We still do have a punishment mentality,
yes.
And we have to get away from that.
Yeah, Judith Brown Dianis, I know this is your last block here at the table with us. I'm glad you said that. And it's something we're going to continue talking about because when I interviewed Attorney General Holder, one of the things he's very passionate about is drug courts and veterans courts, which is really a very new recent model to do some of what I think you're talking about.
I hate drug courts.
You hate drug courts.
Absolutely.
Then I'm going to find out why. Yeah. Thank you, Judith Brown Dianis. Up next, the woman behind Orange is the New Black joins us.
Unlike the normal hive-like communities of prison, 24-hour lockdown leaves you in a 6x8 cell for weeks or months or even years. And this is unproductive for individuals, for prison institutions, and the outside communities to which 97% of all prisoners return.
That was Piper Kerman, author of the book you may have heard of, Orange is the New Black, which also is a Netflix series. She was testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee at a hearing that looked at the use of solitary confinement by federal prisons. When it comes to solitary confinement, changes are coming, but slowly. New York State on February 19th became the largest prison system to reform the way solitary confinement's used. Under new rules, no one under 18 years of age will be put in solitary, nor will anyone who's pregnant, and solitary will be limited to 30 days for those who are developmentally disabled. Small steps, the negative psychological effects of solitary confinement can be permanent for any of the approximately 80,000 inmates who live in some sort of restricted confinement, and the financial costs are pretty staggering. At Pelican Bay State Prison in California, the place where 30,000 inmates protested conditions, including solitary confinement last year, between 2010 and 2011, the cost to house an inmate in security housing units like this was more than $70,000. An inmate in an administrative segregation was nearly $78,000 compared to the usual price of $58,000. So, given the trauma and the cost that solitary confinement brings, why aren't more states looking for alternatives to end the practice completely? Joining us now at the table is Piper Kerman.
Hey.
Thank you for being here.
Hi, all right.
You put a lot of this out into the public consciousness and the culture, particularly because you had a book people wanted to read, which spawned a show people wanted to watch. Mm-hmm. What are your goals here?
In talking about solitary confinement specifically, my goals are to see far fewer people put into both administrative segregation, which is long-term solitary confinement, but also disciplinary segregation, which is theoretically short-term, but is often 90 days, which is a very long time for someone to spend in solitary confinement, particularly if they suffer from mental illness, which a disproportionate number of prisoners do suffer from, and particularly female prisoners.
Right, and you said are we talking only about solitary, because you're working on several things, not only solitary. Let me play some of your testimony on another important issue. Let's listen.
Solitary is also misused as a threat to intimidate and silence women who are being sexually abused by staff, which is a widespread problem in prisons, jails, and detention centers that house women. There are egregious examples of solitary confinement being used by prison officials to hide horrific systemic sexual abuse under their watch. The terrible threat of isolation makes women afraid to report abuse and serves as a powerful disincentive to ask for help or justice.
We wanted to look today at many aspects of the problem in our failed war on drugs and our over-incarceration. We have spent some time talking about a lot of issues. We haven't even gotten to the fact that inside a lot of these prison systems, men and women are facing tremendous illegal sexual misconduct.
That's true. You know, two particularly notorious examples of the problem that I referred to in my testimony include the Otter Creek Correctional Facility in Kentucky, where 400 women prisoners were moved out of the facility because the correctional system of Kentucky just, you know, basically arrived at the conclusion that they couldn't stop the rape culture and the sexual abuse that was taking place there. So rather, they moved all those women out. Currently in Alabama, the Tutwiler prison for women is under DOJ investigation for unbelievable, again, systemic sexual abuse, and that includes the use of solitary confinement to silence the women who are experiencing that.
Solitary confinement is itself abuse. If you go back and look at some of the cases that have been lodged against solitary confinement centers, the details included in them are utterly horrific, and that's for normal solitary treatment, not in the instances where the guards are going far beyond, you know, what is expected or, you know, what is asked of them. People are kept in tiny rooms for 23 hours a day with the lights on. You can't shut the lights off. You're shackled to a pole while they conduct psychotherapy sessions with you. They do mental health interviews with you through the little tiny window in your door so that you can't even have any contact with other human beings. It's just incredibly shocking, and it's incredibly expensive. It's not just the expense of keeping the prisoners, though. There's also a huge legal liability.
Right, and it's hard to hear about. It's hard to think about, which is why people don't want to talk about it. Judge Lewis, when President Bush Sr. appointed you, you were the youngest federal judge. You were on the Third Circuit. You have seen more than a lifetime, one would argue, of a judge on a lot of these issues. How do we change this?
Well, first of all, I think that Piper's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee is going to be very helpful, and I think well received. I believe that there is now a bipartisan effort to address the problem of solitary confinement, as well as a number of the other issues that we've been talking about. When I look at this issue, I do as I hope many do, which is to ask myself, what is this accomplishing? Why are we doing it? And what are the effects? And when you examine the question from that perspective, it doesn't accomplish anything except punishment, and very abusive punishment at that. It doesn't do anything. If anything, it actually enhances the chance of recidivism. And the long-term effects have been documented. Yeah. Heavy psychological effects. And so it really serves no purpose. Now, that said, we have maximum security, supermax penitentiaries in the federal system that are designed to house the most dangerous inmates in the country. And I think that there are some who, whether if they're a danger to themselves or a serious danger to others, there are some significant measures that must be taken. But this is different. I mean, 9-10 months of solitary confinement or longer than that for minor transgressions, significant transgressions. These can be addressed in different ways.
Right, and whether
privileges it's taken away and so forth.
And judge whether it's a last resort or something that is being used commonly and abusively. Up next, as we've been saying, we go to the good news, the solutions to this problem. Stay with us. Community service, fines and restitution, halfway houses, drug courts, probation and community corrections, home confinement and electronic home community service, mental health courts, restorative justice. What do all these things have in common? Well, they're all alternatives to what we've been talking about this hour, the traditional sentencing regime. And according to a December poll. 71% of Americans now favor the elimination of mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent offenders in favor of, for example, discretionary spending. A 2012 public opinion strategy survey shows 69% of those surveys support alternatives to prison for nonviolent offenders. So what is the holdup? That's what we're asking here as we complete an important discussion and panel with judges, with leaders, with libertarians. Judge Lewis, I want to start with something that Eric Holder has been working on, and I had the chance to travel with him to Roanoke, to a veterans court. That is one of the specialty courts we've been talking about. And I want to put up on the screen what the Attorney General has said. By offering alternatives to incarceration and linking participants with vital rehab and treatment resources, this program provides a model for preventing recidivism, reducing relapse, empowering veterans convicted of a certain nonviolent crimes to rejoin their communities as productive, law-abiding members of society. It's also saving resources. I want to tell you, in my reporting on this, I hadn't exactly heard of veterans courts, even though I'm a lawyer. I went in and looked at this, and what did I find? I found that a majority of our incarcerated veterans have drug problems. A majority also suffer from PTSD and emotional strain. This is a piece of this crisis, of this immorality, I think, that might be one of the hardest ones for people to really swallow, that we take men and women who serve this country, risk their lives, they come back with emotional strain, and if they end up self-medicating with drugs or alcohol, they're treated like, well, like a lot of other people who have those problems in this country, which is they're immediately locked up. Judge Russell in Buffalo started, as you know, a veterans court a few years ago. There's now over 100 around the country in the alternatives model, and Attorney General Holder oversaw the first federal one.
Ari, we should be very grateful that we have an attorney general who has served as a prosecutor, as a judge, a defense lawyer, and now is the chief law enforcement officer in the United States, who has praised the Roanoke program, as you mentioned. Of course, I'm familiar with the success in the Buffalo program. Mm-hmm. These are very, very important to the long-term care of, as you pointed out, those who have served our country bravely on the battlefield. Some of these people have brought back with them problems that are unique. And have to be dealt with in a different way. And so these veteran courts are designed to focus on some of the issues that those who have faced combat have or have developed. Now, drug treatment, which is the primary issue here for nonviolent offenders, low-level offenders, is, I think, the smart way to go and the right way to go, because we see what has happened to the prison population by focusing our efforts on mandatory minimums and the other problems that have plagued the criminal justice system for many, many years now. Thankfully, these are changing. I think that veterans court, drug courts in general, right, and any number of other alternative sentencing approaches are very key to that.
And that's something that really is significant, and it's funny. The president had his year of action, but he didn't talk as much in the State of the Union about all the executive action they're taking on this issue because of the politics, which Judge Murphy was talking about. Let me play Attorney General Holder here in our interview talking about his legacy.
I think we have a moment in time now where Congress, as well as those of us in the executive branch, think that it's time to pull back just a bit. And so I think that, I hope that will be a part of my legacy.
Piper, he was saying, let's pull back from using incarceration as the response to every social problem.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of discussion about the conditions of confinement, and there's a lot of discussion about reentry, but the name of the game is the front end of the system. Mm. If we really want to reduce our prison population, and that means sentencing reform, and it means courts reform, and it means innovative courts like the ones that you've described. One caution on the flag there is that those defendants who go into special courts really do need to have defense counsel that is meaningful. Mm-hmm. So they need to have public defenders or court-appointed counsel. 80% of criminal defendants are too poor to afford a lawyer.
Right, and
they rely on a public defender or a court-appointed counsel, and they need to get the same quality of defense that I got.
Right, and we're out of time. I wanted to give a counterpoint to Judge Murphy before we go.
The problem with these reforms is due process, and we see that wherever there is no entitlement to protection on the level that you get in a court, these special courts run over the rights of the people that they're designed to protect. And so in many ways, they make it easy for people to go to jail. They make it easier for people to violate their probation,
right,
because the people involved in these special courts don't get the training and experience that is necessary to understand the nature of addiction and how to deal with it.
And I will say, Your Honor, I appreciate that note of caution and want to make sure to get you in. And I want to thank a very special panel we were able to have here, Judge Tim Lewis, Piper Kerman, Judge Billy Murphy, and Peter Zinnerman. Up next, a deep look into the trial of George Zinnerman. Legal analyst and author of a new book, Lisa Bloom, joins us.